NZ On Air Music presents Long Player.
When I'm dead, roll my body in a rug and bury me in a back road shallow grave. In 10 years, the dogs will dig me up and the cops will say, my God, whose bones are those?
Ahiaki Māori e Tamaki Makoto, you're on 95 BFM. This is Long Player. My name is Paddy Fox, and I am here with DC Maxwell to talk about his brand new album, The Singer. Came out yesterday. How does it feel?
Oh, kia ora, Paddy. Thank you for having me. It feels marvelous. It's lovely to have this new music out after so long, and I'm really excited to share it with the people of Tamaki Makoto and the BFM listeners out there who means so much to me.
Now, your previous album, The Lone Rider, this new one sounds pretty different, going back to your rock and roll roots by the sounds of it.
Yeah, definitely. I think Lone Rider was kind of, looking back on it, was a period of like figuring out what I wanted DC Maxwell to sound like and kind of like playing with a few different ideas and genres. But this album, The Singer, I think it feels a lot more settled in what I actually want to sound like and what I want to say as an artist. I've been working with a producer called Bonnie Knight, who is an amazing Australian producer now based in Los Angeles. They've worked with like Amel and the Sniffers and Angie McMahon, who's a really big country artist in Australia and like produced lots of really great Aussie records, like worked with Body Type, Hot Glue, like lots of really cool bands. And they are amazing. And so Bonnie Knight is the producer of the album.
And who have you got in the band?
So like the live band is a little different to who's on the album, but on the album, we've got my friend and fellow Tamaki Makoto born musician Chase Wallace on guitar, Keely Lawson on bass, who plays with Millie Strange and like a bunch of other really cool Melbourne acts, and Mitch Thomas from Christchurch on drums. Then we've got a really great cast of kind of cameo appearances. The big dog is Bonnie Prince Billy, this like legendary American songwriter on track 5, Half Real, doing a duet with me. We also have Hatchie, this incredible, incredible friend and vocalist. Harriet Pilbeam, is her vocals are all over the album doing backup. Georgia Mack from Camp Cope is on a couple tracks. And Stefan Blair from Good Morning is playing keys and glockenspiel. And then, like every other album released by someone from Auckland in the last 10 years, J.Y. Lee is holding it down on the sax.
Very good.
He is an absolute beast. I've worked with J.Y. a bunch of times, and we were in the studio in Los Angeles trying to figure out, like, the final layers to this album. And I was literally like, there's no one that can do what I want to do other than J.Y. Lee. So shout out J.Y.
All right, let's get directly into it.
Okay, the first track on the album is the title track. It's called The Singer.
So on your last album, you had a lot of storytelling style songs inhabiting a lot of different characters. This album, on the other hand, and especially this first song, sounds a lot more autobiographical to me. Is that correct?
I mean, it is correct in the sense that it is like talking about something I've directly experienced in my life that I want to talk about. I mean, some of the narrative elements are maybe made up. Like I talk about what I would like to happen with my corpse when I die. And I feel like that might be taking a bit of liberty. Like, I'm not sure if I would actually directly like my grieving family to roll my body in a rug and bury me in a back road shallow grave.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I guess in terms of like what the song is wanting to say, it is something, I guess, pretty real to me and something that is like directly influenced by things have happened in my life. So this track, The Singer, is kind of was inspired by this experience of having two really close friends that were musicians pass away in my early 20s. Addison Whitley and Ruben Winter were like huge parts of the Auckland music scene and huge parts of my life and really close friends. And they died very young. And it was this weird experience of seeing how particularly people outside of the music scene would contextualize the deaths of these young people. And especially when I was working as a journalist, seeing the way media had very clean, easy packages they would put the deaths of these young people into. Like, A death of a musician, oh, that makes sense as a trope. And that goes into a story like this.
Kind of a tortured soul type of stereotype.
Yeah, the like, exactly, the tortured artist stereotype. And I think it's unfair on the people that passed away and also everyone that loved them to like kind of simplify their lives in that way. And I think one of the things in particular that really bothered me was the way it kind of framed the act of songwriting as this dark thing that like a tortured soul does for whatever reason, where from my point of view and from seeing my friends, songwriting is like a noble act of like reaching out to the world, and it's like something you do because you're in love with the world and you want to like give something to people. And even if it's a dark song, you are reaching out to someone else and like a dark place and trying to connect with them on that level. So the song is kind of saying fuck you to everyone pushing this kind of tortured artist trope and kind of trying to recontextualize the act of songwriting as a brave thing to do that I'm really proud of my friends for having done.
When I'm dead, roll my body in a rug, bury me in a back road shallow grave. In 10 years, the dogs will dig me up, and the cops will say, my God, whose bones are those? They'll figure out it's just a singer in a band. They'll say, how'd he go and earn a fate like that? Did he steal, did he cheat, or did he lie? Man, I'm glad I ain't got a musician's life. For this one, and anyone singing along, fall in love with this one. Cause anyone mad enough to write songs ain't love for this one. And anyone singing along, fall in love.
Let's move on to track number two. This is your sort of foray into Christian rock. This is this is Jesus' Son. Can you explain this one for us, please?
Yeah, this was a funny. This is the first track we released, kind of the new era of DC Maxwell, and I'm sure a lot of people did consider if it was if we were going full Christian rock. But the words "Jesus' Son" is a Lou Reed line in the song Heroin when he says, and I'm rushing on my run and I feel just like Jesus' son. And it's also a line that was picked up by the poet and writer Dennis Johnson, who wrote this like incredible book called Jesus' Son, which is like about a drug addict who may or may not be the second coming of Christ, just like kind of bumbling through his network of like crazy friends and people and trying to coming back to himself. But the song is, I think both Lou Reed and Dennis Johnson are kind of using that religious language to talk about the like cataclysm of addiction and how that affects like the individual. And I kind of wanted to use the same language to talk about the cataclysm of climate change. And writing that song, I really felt like I was like screaming. I don't know. I find it insane that there's not more people talking about this thing. And I wanted to use like religious language to kind of scream at the heavens and at the world to like try and talk about this like existential threat that like could literally end the world.
Well, it's such a huge emotion to try and grapple with. It's not surprising people are don't feel comfortable tackling it, you know?
Yeah, I think like a big part of it is we don't have the language to talk about it because we've never like faced a problem this big, and our current language is so like insular and so self-focused. Like everyone is so like in their own world on their phones. I mean, I sound like an old man, but it kind of is true. But I actually think the language reflects that. Like if you talk to people, you get like a lot of like, oh, I feel, oh, I do this, oh, I do that. And it's like a lot of self-focused discussion. Whereas religious language is the exact opposite. It is like massively world encompassing and kind of universe encompassing. And it's a language system that is like used to talking about massive things that are like bigger than the individual. So that's why I feel like it is particularly like a good space to kind of discuss climate change. There's this like David Foster Wallace line that I'm paraphrasing where he says something like, everyone has to worship something. We are like worshipful creatures and you can't not worship. And so I feel that to be true. And we live in a world where people are like afraid to worship.
Sonically, it's like a bit of a departure again. I'm getting a lot of like kind of Smashing Pumpkins type of sound. So sonically, what were your influences with this track?
I think for like this track and the whole album, I was listening to like a lot of like 90s, like alt rock. Like you're right to say Smashing Pumpkins. I was listening to a lot of like PJ Harvey from that era, even like Alice in Chains and like that sort of stuff, which is interesting to me because like when I sat down to write this next album, I just felt like the country music space that I had been operating in just wasn't powerful enough for what I wanted to say. And I ended up coming back to this kind of rock world, which is really where I'm from as an artist, like coming from like doing Roids, my first band was like very capital R rock. And it feels like nice coming back to this. Yeah.
Tremble now to see the
track number 3, Golden Light. I believe the blurb for this that you wrote when you put it out as a single was something like, it's a love song for somebody in a dying world. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So I wrote this song after getting married at the start of last year. And one of the things that really surprised me about marriage was how fearful it is and how like scary it is. It's wonderful, but it's also like this terrifying thing where you're basically announcing like, this is the person that I care about. And when we are in a world that is like feels so dangerous and feels like it's teetering on the edge of like destruction constantly, like having someone or having anything that you care about in that unsafe world is like a really terrifying thing. So like the opening lines of the song kind of start as like a traditional love song and then very quickly veer off into like being all about this like fear and anxiety and like the stress of loving someone.
The stakes. You've got something to lose.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a really good way to put it. It's also like, I think this song and like a lot of the songs that I wrote, I wanted to talk about things in a way that I wasn't seeing talked about in other music. You don't hear many love songs that are all about like the fear and anxiety of loving someone in a world that like feels like it's literally crumbling around you.
Mm.
But that ended up being what the song was about. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really stoked. It's like a really fun one to record. I love the kind of like, it's this weird, like syncopated pacing to it. That's like very fast, weird strumming pattern that feels very Royds to me. yeah.
Shape in the glass says that all things come.
All right, moving on. Number four, Funeral Suit. I feel like this one's really fitting into the overall theme of the album, which is there's kind of a preoccupation with death on this album, whether it's your own, others, or the world's. Could you tell us how the song fits into that picture?
Yeah, that is so true. I don't know. I think I think about death a lot, and I think about it in an anxious way, but I also think about it in like the Buddhist sense. Like I practice meditation quite a lot, almost every day, and like reflecting on death is a big part of that. And I find reflecting on death makes the keenness of being alive feel very pointed to me. And that was something I was trying to get across with the music, is that these happy-go-lucky, like, pop song energy of, like, romance and love and, like, the joy of living can, like, coexist with this, like, terrible looming specter of death, like, hanging over all of us. I think the song tries to, like, reflect that in terms of, like, quite dark, droney, weird verses and then, like, very pop, happy choruses. And it was, like, a challenge to myself to try and, like, marry those two ideas into, like, a single song.
One more thing about Funeral Suit is that I understand it's grandparent approved, so that's not an easy thing to get as a musician, so congratulations.
Oh, God, no, especially not for me. My grandparents are lovely, but they're tough customers, and they don't like, there's a long list of things they don't like, so to get this one past them. I can't remember what Nana said about this one. They were like, more of this kind, please.
Nice.
My grandfather, actually, this is just very random, but like for his 90th birthday, we got him a session at Roundhead. And on like very thankful to Dee Stevens for helping suss that. And he went in and like recorded some Elvis songs, and it was very amazing. My grandfather is a great singer too, and comes up with funny songs all the time.
Thank you.
Next up, we have track number 5, Half Real, featuring Bonnie Prince Billy. Before we get into it, you got to explain how that collab came to be.
Yeah, it's like insane to me even now to think that that happened. I listen to Bonnie Prince Billy a lot, and I've listened to him for a long, long time. He's someone who's been covered by like Rosalia and Johnny Cash, and like it's just collaborated with Bjork, and just is like a huge, huge deal in the like alternative scenes. But I think like he is kind of just down to work on stuff that he connects with. And so basically, I sent him a really shitty phone recording of the song and was just like, I'm going to be in America in this time. Would you want to work together on this song? And he said, yes. And then it turned out that the studio we were recording at was literally a 2-minute walk away from where he was staying in Los Angeles. And that is just like insane. Like, that would be insane in Auckland, but in LA, it's crazy. And like, this was not in like the hip cool part of LA either. Yeah. It was just like way out east. So it's just like, it felt kind of like fate.
Meant to be.
It really felt meant to be. And just like watching him work was one of the greatest like creative things I've ever done. It was like getting to apprentice with like an absolute Renaissance master and just seeing how he works and what he brings to the song and this way he has of like tapping into himself and like giving what the song needs at a certain moment. Like, it was just really amazing. I'm very, very grateful.
So when you were writing this, did you have the idea of a collab in mind with anybody at all, or was it a real spur of the moment type of thing?
It was incredibly spur of the moment. I think it was not a duet, basically, until we secured it. But when we had secured the duet, we kind of realized that the song really is like a younger person and an older version of that same person, like talking to themselves like across the distance of time, and kind of like the advice that you want to give your like younger self in pain. And like that conversation really lent itself to such a wise older statesman of like weird songwriting and me coming together, I think. Like, it was just felt very meant to be. I hope I'm not talking about it in such a spooky, weird way, but it was just kind of crazy. It's really simply put together. Like, it's a very folk song in that sense, and there's not a lot going on in terms of the production. I mean, the other reason why it's simple is because I flew into LA, and then the next day, Will Oldham was coming into the studio, and we hadn't done, like, the first thing on that song. So like I asked him to do it and he had the shitty phone demo, but we hadn't done anything else and we needed the like song done basically before he came in and sung on it. So like it was a really kind of put together very quickly, that song. But I think it came together quickly in like a good way. I think the simplicity really lends to it. I'll just say, I guess on the album, this is the one I'm like most proud of, and this is the one that was most difficult to write and the most difficult to sing, and comes from quite an intense place of like pain, but I hope that people connect with it because that makes it kind of worth it. Like, it's both me kind of talking to my younger self and then trying to like send like a beacon out to anyone else in like a similar situation that the song is like could be there for them.
Must have taken a wrong turn somewhere back along the line. This place is looking like a place I left behind. There's the alleyway that poured hate into my heart. There's a reservoir where I stumble back through the dark. How can you love a man who carries this around his head? Like a wreath of flowers on a sacrificial lamb. But if what I feel is just half real, well, that's more than enough to abide. And if time moves fast and I lose my grasp on the things that I set out to find, can remind me if you got the time. I can feel it boiling up through the cracks in my heart. While my body's bathed in light, my mind is screaming in the dark. I see you try to figure out how to get me off this path. Just walk step for step beside me with your hand in my hand. 'Cause if what I feel is just half real, but that's more than enough to abide. And if time moves fast and I lose my grasp of the things that I set out to find, well, there's more to the world than the pain and the hurt around each corner.
Track number six, Strength of a Saint. What can you tell us about this one?
This song, I think, was actually inspired by, I was working at the Hollywood Avondale, and I was like working the door, and I would work in the bar. There were two very young girls that came in, and I was checking their tickets, and one of them said, like, I would kiss you if I was a boy, or something along those lines, which became like the first line of that song. But like, I guess, like a lot of songs, it kind of spun out into like a very interesting place. This song is like very explicitly about like conversion therapy and, you know, showing what a terrible, despicable thing Christian conversion therapy is. And it is terrible and despicable in a quite an interesting way, I think, in which the purpose of it is to convince a person that their like deepest, most internal drives and feelings within themselves are like cosmically bad. I think it's hard for non-religious people to like comprehend the evil of convincing someone of that. So I'm like really happy with the song and how it works, because it doesn't like bang people over the head by being like, oh, conversion therapy is bad. It like kind of takes you through from the perspective of someone going through that, and someone like from the perspective of the person doing the conversion therapy, like a successful conversion, like they end up thinking that what is in themselves is wrong. And I just kind of wanted to like put that there and like leave it for people to make their own decision on, because I think it's impossible to look at and support. The other reason I wanted to write about this was because I think New Zealand has a very short memory of things. Like this was very, very recently became illegal. And we have a current government with a lot of religious fundamentalists that would, given the opportunity, repeal this. And I think because society in general is not religious, there's a danger of kind of being complacent about stuff like that, that is like incredibly damaging. And then it kind of adds another layer, like moving over to Australia, where there's many states where conversion therapy is completely legal and happens all the time, that I'm really happy with this one. I think this takes this kind of storytelling type songwriting I was doing on Load Rider to like quite a few levels up.
I would kiss you if I was a boy, but I'm not. So I keep those thoughts inside. Walking down the street, I reach for your hand, but just as friends, don't you forget it. My daddy tells me only good people get to live after they die. Hard when my heart desires your lips on mine. it on with the strength of a saint. Maybe nothing's wrong. Maybe we're not fooling anyone. Just hold it on with the strength of a saint.
All right, track number 7. This is one of my two favorites. This is Baby Put the Gun Down, another real storytelling style one. Enlighten us, please.
Okay, thank you for asking nicely. You know, enlightenment. this is kind of like an interesting one, thinking from Lone Rider, in which I really like wrote this song as if it was like a Lone Rider style song. Like, you didn't mean to kill that man, but it don't count. Like that kind of like country twang. I mean, obviously none of my songs I like to sing with that kind of accent, but it was like very much like a big strumming country number. And then like very quickly we realized that this album was not going to sound like that at all. And kind of from suggestions from my wife, who was very like, kind of saw the vision for what the song could be, we drastically reshaped it, and it kind of became the most like aggressive rock song on the album, which like I kind of like. I also feel like it's the antithesis, I guess, of the song Last Stand of the Killer on the last Lone Rider album.
Yeah.
Because that song is very much like, here is a violent story told with like a jaunty song, and it's a story of a bank robbery, and there's like, there's layers to it, but I think it's quite simply told. Whereas Baby Put the Gun Down is like a similar world, but the emotion of it is like felt a lot more like deeply and maybe a lot more like subtly. And I think I'm thinking a lot harder about what it actually would feel like to be in that position.
Yeah, it's a story told from like the villain's point of view, which is always really compelling, if it's done right, which it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to think of any of the characters in my songs as villains. Like, I think I kind of approach it from like a fiction writing sense, in which to like judge people, I don't know, you like lose something in the audience, I think, when your first instinct is judgment.
Hmm.
Like, there's this Buddhist idea of becoming like a dispassionate like observer of your own thoughts when you meditate, and kind of not passing judgment on the thought, but just kind of recognizing that it's there. And I find like songwriting is quite a similar practice, in that you are kind of trying to very simply and clearly tell a tale or like share an emotional world, but without pressing your own hands into the clay.
You didn't mean to kill that man, so it don't count. God knows the little bastard deserved it. The night is flashing lights outside, so I reload the gun. You climb out the window and you goddamn run. I appreciate the tears, I know you want to stay. Being brave's got nothing to do with it. If I were to die tonight, the world would lose a freak. But it would dim the stars if you would come with me. But loving you and being loved was a moment in the sun. They can't kill me now, cause I've already won. We'll be right back. gone down.
All right, track number 8, In Heaven. This is my other contender for top 2 tunes on the album.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really filling out the religious theme on the album here too. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, this was another one we did mostly in LA with me and Bonnie. Bonnie Knight, not Bonnie Prince Billy. It is kind of like a weird droning fable, I guess, that is kind of about addiction. Well, it's not kind of about it, it's probably is about addiction. And kind of, it's talking about in heaven, but it's like quite a devilish, like tempting voice talking, trying to like bring someone back into the world of addiction. And I mean, for me, I think about it as being like about alcoholism. At this point, I've been sober for 8 months. But when I wrote the song, weirdly, I wasn't sober. And it was so weird. Like at that point, I had like written the song, which was like framing addiction and alcohol in this way. But I hadn't like, I think that's a really, it was an interesting example of like the songwriting part of you being like more tapped into the world than my actual like thinking brain. Cause like it would have been like, you know, almost a year after I wrote the song, I hadn't gone sober yet. Yeah, I don't know. I really like the song. I think it's like really weird. I think the writing's really good, if I'm allowed to say that. And I, again, it's like, I guess using this religious language to talk about like something bigger than us. We talked before about like being careful what you worship. Like, I think worshiping substances and worshiping addiction is like something that is has potential danger to it, for me at least.
It's really interesting that you're far from the first songwriter to say that you wrote something and then you lived it after the fact. And it's very interesting, like you say, that there's some subconscious level of you that songwriting can tap into where you kind of know what you need to hear long before you're actually consciously ready to internalize that.
Totally. It's really spooky. I mean, like Leonard Cohen has this great line, "If I knew where the good songs were, I would go there more often." And I think about that a lot. And I think about songwriting is really only when it's really badly done is it like purposeful and done with like so much knowledge and like, oh, I know where I want to go and I went there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like if you are kind of being open to what the song wants to do and kind of like following it through twists and turns, it can be very spooky and surprising. Yeah.
I will also just say that one of the things that really caught me about the song was just how sort of haunting and the way that the writing kind of paints a picture, like the shattering of the bottle on the underpass is very evocative without saying too much at all. And my interpretation of it was actually struggling with like suicidality, which
right.
I can see relating a lot, but just the atmosphere that it builds both musically and lyrically makes it one of my top picks out of this album for sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Patty. I really appreciate that. I mean, I'm nervous to say like the song is about this because like for me, it, when I think about it, I think about that, but I'm really happy that you can like come to the song and like and hear something different. I guess it works for any person wrestling with some darker element of the world. And I really wanted to like get the like temptation element, which is obviously a fairly religious idea, but I think in actual practice, the thing that is often like misunderstood about addiction or even about other dark forces is that they work. Like it's a actual solution for some people until it's not, you know, like that's people get addicted because it does something profound for them. And I think any kind of discussion of addiction that doesn't like wrestle with that idea is lacking.
Take the stone and wet the knife, the blade it draws your face's lines. It's a kind of thing that they don't mind in heaven. Bottle cap and bottle glass smash against the underpass, a piece swept away, nothing like that. Heaven.
Let's get into the last track on the album, track number 9. The song's called Right Line, and to me it really kind of brings it full circle from track number 1, the singer, about really being a little meta about the concept of being a songwriter or a singer, the role of it and its purpose.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I definitely see those two songs as like bookending this like statement I wanted to make about singers and songwriting and like what it means to be an artist in this like crazy age that we're living in. Right Line for me, I guess, goes back to like what I discussed in The Singer about two close friends of mine, Addison and Ruben, passing away early in my life and very early in their life. And that moment for me was felt a little like a betrayal, not of them, but of like music itself. Like this was this thing that all of us were like living for, and the fact that it hadn't, in my head at that time, I felt it hadn't done enough to save them, I guess. I mean, that sounds, I maybe I'm not talking about this in the best way, but I mean, like after their deaths, I felt like that music maybe wasn't what I thought it was. I had like fallen out of love with it. And I had like 3 or almost 4 years of like not picking up a guitar once, which was kind of crazy looking back on it. And I really was like denying that part of myself. Yeah. So I think now of like Lone Rider almost as like a practice run, but also as like this thing that was like a real moment of me like coming back to myself. And the song Right Line is like taking really seriously this idea of that music and songs are literally this like magic thing that like can help people in distress and can change people's lives. And it has done that again and again and again for me. And I wanted to like add a song to the canon of songs about songwriting. There's a really, really good like David Berman line from the Purple Mountains, and snow is falling in Manhattan, and he says like songs build little rooms in time, and housed within the song's design is the ghost the host has left behind. And I don't know, I think that's amazing. It gives me a shiver. Yeah,
I will also say that I can kind of hear a bit of Ruben on this album like throughout, you know, just as a presence.
Yeah, and I think like there's a lot of Ruben on this album. Like Ruben was like my first producer and like one of the first people to like really take Royd seriously as a band and kind of like pushed it into being an actual thing. And there's also like a lot of Addison who really, really was like the first friend I had in the Auckland music scene who kind of, like, I think one of the big turning points in my life was there wasn't enough people that signed up to Smoke Free Rock Quest both in North Shore and in West Auckland. So they smushed the North Shore and West Auckland heats together, and that's when I met Addison and Fraser Hunter in this band Heroes for Sale. And yeah, there's like a lot of those guys on this album, and I am happy that you hear that, because that is like true, not even in like a woo-woo mystical sense. Like, it's true in that I knew these people and they had such an insane presence and energy that like I have in me now through the act of having known them and played music with them. And that exists within lots of people that met them and knew them, and that, and in that way they are still here and they are still like influencing the world.
I think they'd be very proud.
Oh, thanks, Patty. That means a lot. Yeah. Cheers.
That was The Singer by DC Maxwell, played in full, available now. You've been listening to Long Player on 95BFM. My name is Paddy Fox. Thank you very much, Daniel, for joining me.
Thank you, Paddy, for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I would really love to ask the people of Auckland to come buy my record from my Bandcamp, dcmaxwell at bandcamp.com, because this album is like completely independent. It's completely self-funded through like a day job of like being a furniture removalist here in Melbourne. And I've actually put a lot of blood, sweat and tears into it. And when I think about it, I genuinely think like the people of Auckland and the place that I'm from and this music scene is like who I have in my mind when I'm like making music and doing stuff. So I would love for you guys to listen to it and enjoy it. So lots of love out to Tamaki.
Thank you, Daniel. DC Maxwell, the singer, out now.
That was Long Player. Thanks, NZ On Air Music.